Welcome, everyone, to our Parsha review class. Bereshis, a Big Bang, a serpent, and a fallen angel. Now, the Big Bang part, it's going to be there, but not really critical or germane to tonight. But what I want to emphasize, first of all, is just the context of our Parsha, okay? Many people look at the Torah as a history book. Now, we know it's not a history book. It's not meant to be a chronology of events in real time. It's not that. So much so that the very first comment, the most famous Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, Rashi, in the whole Torah, because it's the first one, he asked this question. He said, what's the purpose of the book? Is it a book of history? Is it simply a book of precepts, of commandments, of mitzvos? Because if it is a book of mitzvos, why not just weiter, as they say in Yiddish, why not just fast forward, go to the first mitzvah in the book of Exodus, the new moon, the new month, the Jewish people, Chodesh Hazeh Lachem, this is your new month, the Jewish people are about to become free people and get to Sinai, that's really the crux of the matter. We'll just fast forward it, and if you're not going to really tell the story of Genesis in a meaningful way that is both palatable and intelligible to the average person, why bother? That's Rashi's question. We're not going to answer, so that's just floating it out there. But what does that show you? That in a couple of hundred words, it's not meant to be taken literally. And if you participated perhaps in Professor Harold Ganz's classes, you know that to even understand some of the basic words, mayim, water, rakia, the firmament, whatever that is, you can go to a physics class and you can go to a quantum physics class and still not really digest what in the world it's talking about. So much so that, believe it or not, the day school system called Torah Masorah doesn't begin the curriculum with either Genesis, Bereshis, or Noah. They begin at Lech Lecha with Abraham. Because the first two parshas are so difficult and so obscure and so obtuse, so that to teach it to little kinderlach, little 6-7-year-old boys and girls, is just for what purpose?
We started with Bereshis.
We don't with Torah Masorah. They jettison that. Yeah, I'm sorry. Things have changed. Not for the better, necessarily. Now, we do it in Parsha. In other words, when you review the Parsha, then it can just be story, right? Friday, you have a Parsha review. You send the little kinderlach home with their little questions and answers to embarrass the parents, right? So that already, you know what I'm talking about. The Rebbe's always send home the Q&A, right? That the little Johnny or Chaim or Susie has to come home and ask the question to show how much or how little their parents know. And then they have to sign off on it after Shabbos and return it. Yes, I stumped to my parents with 16 questions out of 20, right? They were clueless. So clearly then, Bereshis, Genesis, which we're going to tackle tonight, is not meant to be a chronological history of the world. So much so that we know that the beginning of our clock, per se, doesn't start ticking till after creation itself, till the so-called eighth day. 7 days, Shabbos, creation of the world, the first Shabbat, then everything begins. Now, that is very germane to tonight because the famous story in the Garden of Eden, Gan Eden, Adam, Eve, the serpent, the tree of knowledge, we're going to tackle this tonight, it is not a part of human history. It is, in fact, something that occurred on day 6, the day that Adam and Eve were created. Now, why is this important? Well, think about it for a moment. History literally is his story, correct? It's the story of our people, of mankind, so to speak, not even the Jewish people. But if it happened as part of creation, then it's no longer a story of history. It is part and parcel of Bereshis itself, of creation, which means it's the human condition. So the story should only be taken literally at your own peril and, unfortunately, your own ignorance. Not for you, I'm saying, but for the greater world. Because clearly it's very allegorical. It's not really what it seems at all, but it's meant to teach us profound lessons, nevertheless, as we'll see tonight, hopefully. I'd like to begin with the famous tree. So a question, of course, begs itself. How many trees were there in the garden? And we know there was a plethora of trees. Adam and Eve were allowed to eat from any tree they were desirous of, except for the tree that is described as being the Eitz Hadas Tov Vara, the tree of knowledge, both good and evil. Okay? And here's a question you may have pondered in your studies. What did Adam and Eve gain by eating from the fruit of the tree of knowledge? Well, you would say knowledge. Clearly, right? Dat. Knowledge. Okay. And what did that give them? Free choice. What we call bechira chashis. Freedom of choice. Well, here's the question. If they didn't have free choice in advance of the consumption of the fruit, but only subsequent, how could they have chosen to go against the will of God? Do you hear that? In other words, they transgressed by eating, following the advice of the Nachash, of whatever that serpent was. We'll discuss this tonight. But how were they able to do this if, in fact, they didn't have the freedom of choice? So that's a problem. Okay, let's look at source one. So it says that God made grow out of the ground, Vayatzmach Hashem Elokim, min hadama, from the earth, kol eitz, every type of tree, nechmad l'mareh, that was pleasant to look at, v'tov l'machal, and good to eat. V'eitz hachayim b'toch hagan, and there was the tree of life in the midst of the garden, in the middle of the garden. V'eitz hadat tovara, along with the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Okay, let's stop for a second. Based just on this verse, Genesis 2:9, Perek Beis, Pasuk Tes, what is the location of the tree of knowledge? Well, the answer is we don't know. But we do know the location of the tree of life, right? The Eitz HaChayim, the tree of life. It's in the Toch. Whether that is literally the middle or just the midst, somewhere in that area of the middle, but not literally in the middle. But that's not really neither here nor there. Okay. The Eitz HaDas, though, we don't know, right? Would you agree? According to that narrative description, this is the layout of the garden. Where is the tree of knowledge? We don't know. Now, why is this important? Because look at the next source. So let's fast forward to the third chapter, Perek Gimel. The serpent, it says, V'hanachash, haya arum mikol chayas ha-sadeh asher asah Hashem Elokim. He was the most cunning of all the wild beasts that God had made. The serpent asked Chava, the woman, he said to her, come on, dear, did God really say that you may not eat from any of the trees of the garden? Look, this is a paradise, and yet you are very limited. You're like a little zoo creature that you get fed a little bit of food once or twice a day. You like this existence? Really? The woman replied to the serpent, that's not true, she says to the Nachash. Mipri eitz hagan nochel. We may eat from any of the fruit of the trees of the garden. Anyone. Except umipri ha'eitz, except for the fruit from the tree. This is the humdinger. Asher b'toch hagan. But the tree that is in the midst of the garden, Amar Elokim lo tochlu mimenu. God said, don't eat from that tree. V'lo tigavo, don't touch it. Pen temutu, because you're going to die. Hello? Do you see the problem? There's only one tree that is b'toch hagan. We already defined it in source one. What's the tree that's in the middle of the garden? The tree of chayim, life. What? Now, you could answer the following answer. Perhaps, right? You could say, well, come on. The word toch, let's nitpick for a moment. It doesn't mean literally in the middle. So, you know, the tree of knowledge is here, the tree of life is here, they are adjacent to each other, and they are both betoch, right? Okay, that's a possible answer, but there's a problem. Never described the whereabouts of the tree of knowledge. So even if you want to say it's not a literal description, the only tree that's betoch, whether it's literally the middle or just in the midst, there's only one tree that refers to, the tree of life. But the tree of life's good. We want to eat from the tree of life and live forever. It's only after we eat from the tree of knowledge and have this evil potentiality, God says, hey, no, lest he'll eat from the tree of life, and then we're really up a creek because he's going to have the knowledge to destroy the world, and he's going to live forever. Then he throws them out of the garden, right? So what's going on here? So my Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, that's all, said the following. This is his report. In fact, there was only one tree. One tree. There was the Eitz HaChayim, which was also, in fact, the Eitz HaDas, the tree of knowledge and the tree of life, the tree of life, the tree of knowledge, one and the same. But the answer is simple. Your machshava, the intent of the consumer, define the reality of the tree. So if you ate with the intent of the serpent to gain godlike powers to choose between tov v'ra, good and evil, reality became defined by you. If you ate with righteousness to follow the edict of God, Eitz HaChayim, that you wanted to live forever, then it was the Eitz HaChayim. One and the same. Now it's stunning because this duality, this double-edged sword, the Cherev HaMitapechet, which ironically, that sword was placed in front of the garden when Adam and Eve are kicked out to sort of protect the garden from man's re-entry into the garden, into paradise, whatever that means, metaphorically speaking, that is a reality of our world. We define a reality. And we're going to see tonight that this is brought home in the most amazing Maimonides Rambam that we're going to deal with shortly. Okay? But I just want everyone to hear that. Again, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, Zatzal, Zichron Baruch, the Rashiv of Neir Yisrael, saying that there's one tree and they're one and the same. Now, what was the fruit of the tree? And this is so beautiful because there's a huge argument about what the fruit was. By the way, the one fruit that we know wasn't was an apple tree. Sorry about that. For all those New York State apple growers, Washington State, you know, it's not an apple tree, okay? But it could be grapes. Why? Because grapes are made, you know, wine, and people get shicker as Noah gets drunk and bad things happen to people, you know. Could be wheat, because we define das, knowledge, when a baby is old enough to digest wheat. So it could be wheat. Another one, it could be etrog. Could be an etrog tree, the citron that we use on Sukkot. How do we know that? Because it says tov, it was good to both eat and to look at. The tree, not the fruit of the tree, the tree was good to eat. Believe it or not, and I've heard this from my Rebbe, I've never tried this, but if you're in Israel and you see an etrog tree, if you take a piece of the bark off and suck on it, it tastes exactly like an etrog. Has that citron flavor. So it's the bark, the branch itself, has the taste of the fruit. So therefore, that could be. Now, the fact that they debate, and it could be this, it could be that, also, again, puts almost in our image that it's our definition of what it is that becomes the reality. And we know that it's true in our life, right? That if we are predisposed to something, if we perceive something to be a reality, it becomes a reality for us. Sort of like I remember they were teaching me how to get out of a spin. This is in Canada when you have icy highways entering, you know, you have little turns. And the guy was trying to explain to me, he says, you know, when you're coming around the turn and your back end starts to come around, not a good thing, right? He says, the one thing you never want to do is look where you're going, because that's exactly where you're going to hit. He says, you look where you want to be. So in other words, he says, you don't even have to do it. You don't have to go to a, you know, parking lot at late at night to try this. When it gets icy, don't do it on a highway, please. But they say that when you look at the hole that you want to hit to get out of it, and your hands and feet and brake, you will do what you need to do physiologically to get there. Whereas if you're looking at the stone wall ahead of you and you're going, oh my gosh, you're going to hit the stone wall, because it becomes the definition of reality. In the same way here, eating from the fruit of the tree, clearly Adam and Eve had nefarious intentions when they ate. They were desirous of godlike powers. It became a reality for them. Okay? Let's turn now to this amazing Maimonides. Now, I have it in Hebrew at the bottom on page 1. It's in English on page 2, source 3. But the Hebrew is so much better. It's much more precise and exact. So I'm going to read you the Hebrew. And you can follow along with me in the English or just follow with me in the Hebrew. There's no vowels. I'm sorry about that. It's going to challenge your Hebrew tonight a little bit. I apologize. Maimonides says, in of all places, laws of repentance, of Teshuvah, 5th chapter. He defines for us, essentially, every mad man and woman who ever existed, how this madness became a reality for them. It's a stunning Rambam. Listen to what he says. Rishut kol adam, license, permission, freedom of choice has been netuna lo, has been given to every man and woman in this world. God has given you free license. Im ratza, if a person wishes, lahatot atzmo, lederach tova, if he wishes to follow, to push himself after a good path, a good way in life, uvelehiyot tzadik, to become a righteous individual, a tzadik, harshit biyado, the power is in his hand. You have the license to do this. that if you want to choose a path of evil for yourself, to become an evil person, how should be ado? God has given you the permission to do this also. And that's what it means when it says in the Torah, God worries after Adam and Eve eat from the fruit. They say, oh my gosh, now man knows the difference between good and evil. We better get rid of him because he now has acquired the ability to differentiate between good and evil, whatever path he wants to choose. And if he chooses the negative, the bra, oh my gosh, let's get him out of the garden. Klomar, as if to say, the species of man is unique in the entire world. And in this area, there is no second creation of God that has this power of evil or good, good and evil, to create a reality. Because a man knows, every human being knows with his intelligence and with his intellect, he knows the difference and he knows how to understand what is good and what is evil. He does whatever he desires. And this is the craziest statement. And there is nobody who's able to stop this person from doing good or from doing evil. God doesn't stop you. You have this license. Now, that doesn't mean God couldn't stop you, but he wound into the fabric of creation, the Rambam Maimonides is saying. He does not interject. You have this power. We have this power. This is astounding. Now, what is Maimonides saying? He's saying essentially the following. We have the power, as human beings, uniquely, to create an artificial universe for ourselves. And in that universe, we believe this to be a reality. We define our reality, like we did by the tree, whether it is the tree of knowledge or the tree of life. We define our own reality. And it could be, in a worst-case scenario, that the reality only exists one place in this world, our mind. But there's no other human being of the 7+ billion people on Earth who would share that reality. That happens all the time. Right? What was the person in Oregon or in Newtown thinking? You get up in the morning, you're going to shoot everybody at school? You're angry, your kindergarten teacher, so you're going to go murder 30 little children in Connecticut? Really? You're in Columbine or all over the Middle East, tragically? In other words, what reality are you defining? That's the whole point Maimonides is saying, is that God gave uniquely to man and man alone the ability for ultimate good or ultimate evil. And he does not interject. This is our freedom of choice. Now, he doesn't use the word freedom of choice. What does he use? License. Almost like James Bond, right? 007 had a license to
kill.
We have a license to kill, to create or to kill. And God says this is the nature of our world. And it's an amazing thing. And it plays perfectly from Rabbi Weinberg and the way he sees the tree as one. Because that's the reality. What was the fruit? How do you see the fruit? How do you understand it to be? And we all know this is true because everyone experiences things subtly differently from the other, right? You may go to a marvelous performance and the person next to you who you love dearly may shake their head and say, that was just the worst movie or the worst, you know, play that I've ever seen, and you think it's the most wonderful experience. Of course, once you hear them say it, you're like, You second guess yourself, right? I hate the critics, right? Because when you read the critics ahead of time, you project their criticism, either their love or their hate for something, into the performance. We all do this. How could you help but do this? So we're saying then, this Maimonides is saying something stunning, that the gift, which is a huge gift, that was given to man, is to create a world or to destroy our world. I leave that for you to decide what type of job we're doing at this very moment in time. Okay? Let's go on. We'll come back to this a little bit later. There is a Talmudic quote in my first tractate that I ever had the honor of learning called Chulin. Chulin is the tractate that revolves around Shechita, essentially how you basically kosher slaughter an animal. Do not ask why that was my first Talmudic tractate, but it was. So at the very end of this tractate, there is a chapter that revolves around Shiluach HaKan, Shiluach HaKain, sending the mother bird away in the beautiful mitzvah. And out of nowhere, almost like it's just like a shot that rings out, and you're shocked by it, the Talmud starts asking seemingly crazy questions. But you're going to see that these questions are all going to weave into tonight's class. So the Torah asks the following. Ready? It works much better in the Hebrews. It's source number 4. Moshe min ha-Torah, the Talmud asks. Moses from the Torah, minayin. Where do we know that Moses is in the Torah? Gee, I don't know. There are 4 books that kind of he wrote, and he's in every second verse, you know? Obviously, that's not what the Talmud's asking. It's saying the following. Before there was a Moses, is there an allusion, a remez, a hint, somewhere maybe like in Genesis, before Moses is on the scene in Exodus, in Shemos? Is there something in Bereshit that maybe is a precursor, and that is like a, you know, foreshadows the great Moses' birth and existence? Actually, there is. So, again, let me read it to you. Minayin, from where do we know that Moses was going to exist, that there is an allusion? So, in Genesis, in our Parsha, it says, Bishagam hu basar. God says, my spirit shall not quarrel forever concerning man, because he is also flesh. His days shall be 120 years. Now, how is that an allusion to Moses? Well, Bishagam, this is word number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, okay, in source 4 in Hebrew. If you add up the bet, which is 2 in Gematria in Jewish numerology, Shin, of course, is 300, Gimel is 3, and Mem, or Mem Sofit, the final Mem, is 40. So that adds up to 345. Let's add up Moshe's name. You know what it's going to be, right? Shin is 300. Mem is 40, and Hey is 5. So Bishagam, in as much, equals Moses, Moshe, in Gematria, in Jewish numerology. That's strange, okay? But then what does the verse go on to say? Because man is flesh. Now what is God saying? Because man is attached to flesh, that he can't escape the earth that he came from. That meaning, what? That man's going to sin. Man is destined to corrupt the world, then he can't live 1,000 years like Adam, like 969, like Methuselah, like Mrs. Shelach, right? They got it wrong, and it ain't necessarily so. I think they only say it's 900 years. I'm sorry. But Porgy and Bess, they got it wrong. It's actually 969. He's not going to live 969, because he lives 969, it's a disaster for the world. The world will cease to exist. So he defines man's lifetime as what? 120 years. Gee. Can you tell me what human being lived exactly to the day of his birthday and his death, 120 years? Moses. Why do we wish somebody in Judaism, Ad Me'eva Esrim? We say, may you live till 120 years because of this verse. Right, it's like the old joke, what do you wish someone is 119 years old?
Long life.
Right, you say long life, you don't say to them, may you live to 120. So this then is an allusion to Moses. He is Bishagam, Gematria, Jewish numerology, Moses. He's going to live 120 years. Great. Then it gets bizarre, if that wasn't bizarre enough for you. And then it asks the following. You've got to love this one. This is about 8, 9 words in. Haman min ha-Torah minayin. Where do we know about Mr. Hamatashin hat? Haman, from the story of Purim. Where is there an allusion to him somewhere in the Torah? Now remember, the book of Esther is not part of the 5 books of the Chumash. It's a Megillah. It's later on in Nach. Okay? But apparently there's an allusion to Haman. And believe it or not, he's in the Garden of Eden, the allusion. And he's right in our parsha that we just discussed. Not a surprise, as we'll see. So Haman min ha-Torah minayin. Where is there an allusion that there's a guy with a triangle hat is eventually going to come around and he's going to attempt to commit genocide against the Jewish people? Our parsha. Hamin ha'etz? God says, oh my gosh, if I leave man and woman here in the garden, what if it's a disaster? And he asks Adam, Hamin ha'etz? From the tree that I told you not to eat, did you eat? Hamin ha'etz? Only problem is, in the Torah, are there any nukudot or any vowels? No. So when you read the word hamin, hey mem nun, it also spells hey mem nun, haman. It's the same name, same word. So we're reading it, Hamin as Haman, from the tree. And of course Rashi, in one of the most humorous little Rashi side points, says, well, what's the connection between Haman and a tree, anybody? Because he ended up getting hanged on a tree. So that's an allusion. Hamin ha'etz. Haman is hanged upon a tree. So that's an allusion that Haman's going to exist, and his denouement will be on a tree. Okay, and I'll come back to that in a second. And Esther min ha-Torah minayin, where do we know that Queen Esther also is alluded to in the Torah? V'anochi haster astir. God says, on the day that you mess up, on the day that you go against my will, I will destroy your temple, I will hide my face from you. Now Esther's name means hidden. Remember, we learned the book of Esther. Esther had to hide. Hadassah was her real name, her Jewish identity. It was a time of God's countenance being hidden from the Jewish people because the temple had just been destroyed, Temple 1. The Jewish people were in exile in Persia, correct? So it was a time of Hester Panim, of God's countenance being hidden from the world. And Esther is alluded to that she's going to come around, save the day, and bring the Jewish people back from exile, rebuild Temple number 2. Now, let's get back to Haman for a moment and Moses. And by the way, is there a relationship between Moses, Haman, and Esther? Come on. We did the Book of Megillah classes. Good. Anyone remember? We just alluded to it a moment ago. 120 years, Moses dies. Seventh day of the Jewish month of Adar. Same month as Purim. So Haman went to Hebrew school, or at least he pretended to. Maybe he went online or something. And he learned that the anniversary of the death, the yahrzeit for Moses' death, was the seventh day of Adar. So in his famous lottery, the lottery is rolled, and it comes out with the month of Adar. He's looking, he says, hey dear, he says to his wife Zeresh, what's the Jewish holiday in the month of Adar? And they're looking at their it's set a calendar, and there's no holidays. Anybody die? They said, yeah, Moses died. Moses died? What day? Seventh day of Adar. The same Moses who killed my great-grandparents, the Amalekites? Yeah. Oh my gosh, that's like a great sign from heaven that I should make this destructive day, this genocidal day, should be the 13th day of Adar. Great, wonderful. So it was the error of Haman in thinking that Moses was only memorialized on Adar, but he forgot that he was born in Adar, which is a good thing, right? Oops. So you see there's interplay because Moses creates Haman's false illusion of security and success, and Esther comes along, of course, and destroys Haman. So all three are interrelated. And I skipped the next one, but it actually asks Mordechai from the Torah, where do you know this? So clearly, it is a Purim little Torah spiel. But I heard something this past week I want to share with you that is like mind-bending. Okay? So let's look at Haman again. And then we'll come back to Moses. So what was the allusion to Haman? Remember we said, Hamin ha'etz. Did you eat from the tree, God asks Adam in a rhetorical question? Really? I gave you one commandment to do. Remember, there were not 613 commandments. There was one commandment given to Adam. Don't eat from the tree of knowledge. And he lasted, a couple hours. Great job, Adam. Thank you. And Adam even himself says to God, Eirom Anochi, I am naked. I am bereft of commandments. I have no merits. You gave me one commandment, and I dropped the ball in an egregious way. Okay, I'm sorry, God. Now, Hamin ha'etz, Haman from the tree. So it's a play on words because he's going to get hanged on a tree, hung on a tree. But there's more than that. Haman and Adam shared the same problem. Let's discuss this. What was Adam's problem? He's in the garden, and he has the world as his kosher oyster. He's got everything, right? But what? What doesn't he have? Doesn't have the fruit of the tree of knowledge. One thing in the world is off limits to him. What does it do to Adam? Drives him ballistic, correct? Haman had exactly the same problem.
He doesn't know that. He didn't have knowledge yet, so how did he know?
No, but he does. He knows that everything else is okay. God only said, from the tree in the middle of the garden, don't eat, right? That he knows. Everything else ostensibly is his for the taking. The whole world is his. Literally, there's nothing else that is denied, is held back. Let's talk about Mr. Haman. Haman famously goes to King Ahasuerus. He convinces the king to write the famous letter. Destroy the Jews next 13th day of Adar, right? The king, Haman, they sit down, they drink, they make merry. And then when Mordechai in the next chapter gets word of it, what happens? Of course, he goes out and he wears sackcloth and ashes and he gets everyone to pray. Haman leaves the palace. he has just been invited by Esther, who he thinks has the hots for him, which is by design. That's what Esther wanted him to think. She's invited him for the second time to a personal party. King, queen, and Haman. Haman must be thinking, oh my gosh, she sees that I'm going to get rid of the hubby, and she's not too hot on Ahasuerus, and, you know, Esther's kind of cute, doesn't know she's a Jewish girl. But anyways, so he's coming out, and he's at the zenith, as we say in Canada, the zenith of his powers. He has all the money because Ahasuerus the king denied his request for money. So he kept the 10,000 talents of silver. He kept his $400 million in the bank. So he's got a full bank account. He's the prime minister of the entire world, about to be the king of the world. He's got the most beautiful woman in the world coming up. And the best part of it, he has the king's signet ring, signing the death of the Jewish people. It's all perfect. But he walks out of the palace, and Mordechai is sitting right there. And what does Mordechai not do? Doesn't bow or acknowledge him. And he goes ballistic. And he goes home. And he walks in, he's ranting like a lunatic, which he is. And he says to his lovers, La'ohavav, to Zeresh, Ishto, and all the people who love Haman, all 23 of them, and he says, oh my gosh, you wouldn't believe it. I have the wealth and the money. He even goes through it. He recounts for them, Osher, his wealth and his honor and everything that he has in the world. He says, but that Mordechai won't bow. I want him dead now, right? And that's when they concoct the plan to build the gallows and to hang him, which ultimately destroys him. Right? So, again, the world is Haman's. One thing is off limits to him. Mordechai. He has everything else in the world. Adam had everything else in the world except for the tree that hangs Haman, right? It's the same issue. He's an ingrate. He is looking, I believe you said this, Dr. Kelman, he's looking at the tiles. Who said the tiles? Was that, I heard it recently, where you look up and you have the beautiful tiles on the ceiling and there's one tile missing and the whole ceiling is like a mosaic and you focus on the one tile that's missing. So there's one tile in the life of Adam, in the life of Haman, that is absent. And that's all he can see is the one absent tile. How often are we guilty of that in our own lives? We have such a myriad of blessings and yet all we can see is one, not even something we need. Because remember, Mordechai is about to die along with the rest of the Jews. But it's going to happen next 13th of Adar. Really? I mean, you need that fruit, Adam? You have thousands of other trees to eat from. So in other words, it's not even a need. It's just a want. It's a belief. It's a projection of what you might want. Okay? So see how the Haman, Haman, Nin Ha'etz. So this is just gorgeous because it weaves in the Haman issue with the Adam issue and Eve issue. Okay, let's step back now for a moment. I want to finish off with the fallen angel. And in order to do that, we have to talk about Moses. Now remember, it said Moses, Bishagamhu Basar. Gematria numerology, because he is flesh and attached to the ground, man only gets to live 120 years, which is the life we said coincidentally of Moses. So it's an allusion to Moses, correct? Okay. There was one person in the world whom Moses feared. Only one in the whole Torah. And his name was Og Melech HaBashan. Og, the king of the Bashan. Only person. Didn't fear Pharaoh. Didn't fear anyone else. Nimrod, you know, whoever he met. Right? I'm sorry?
Not even his wife.
Okay, fine. Sipporah, maybe, right. Absolutely, Mr. Farah, that's good. Good point. Okay. Other than the boss, right? He didn't fear anyone else in his life, except for Og. And we are told this, because God says to Moses, Al tira oto, don't fear Og. I'll give him to you, just like you did away with his half-brother Sichon, the giant. He'll be yours. And the next day, they have a war. Og is killed by Moses. No worry. Well, what was the issue with Og? Now, Og is a fallen angel. So let's discuss Og for a moment. Fascinating character. One of my favorites in the whole Torah. He's an antediluvian. Og is the only angel to make the transition from angelic status to human status. When man is created, we don't do very well, as you heard earlier tonight, correct? The angels mock man. Ma enosh kitus karana. Why are you creating this very, very stupid human who's going to just mess up our world? Really, God, this is the best you could do? Moses, when he goes up Sinai, he ascends to the Marom, it says, to heaven. He defends the creation of the Jewish people and of mankind in the angels' presence, and they love him. They eat him up. He's the superstar. They love Moses. Now think about Moses and Og for a moment. Moses is a man who starts off as flesh and blood, but through perfection of character and soul, he ascends to heaven and becomes like an angel. That we're told for 40 days and 40 nights, three different times, he doesn't eat or drink. He becomes, for all intents and purposes, an angel. What was Og? Og was one of the angels who, after the disaster of Adam and Eve and Noah, right? The angels say, God, you know, give us a chance. Here we are, we're up in heaven, things are good, but we could do better. Send us down in the guise of humans, we'll show you how much greater we could be than this Adam, than this mankind. Now, what was an angel before that moment? Pure intelligence. They had no body. Now, you might say, well, don't they take the guise of a body when they come down on earth? Whatever you understand an angel to be. But their intellect, they're pure spirit without a body. Correct? But then God says, I'll give you a body. So all these angels are given bodies. They come down to earth. And as soon as they touch the soil, and as soon as they get a look at the girls, that's it. It's over for them. So whatever they mocked man for doing, they destroy the world. How do we know this? Look at Source 5. And the Lord said, let my spirit not quarrel forever concerning man, because he is also flesh, and his days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim, the fallen ones, were on the earth in those days, and also afterward. When the sons of the nobles would come to the daughters of man, and they would bear for them, they are the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. Who were the Nephilim? They were the giants, the fallen ones. Why are they called Nephilim, Rashi says? They were called Nephilim, the fallen ones, because they fell, Naflu, and caused the world to fall. They destroyed our world. They brought the Mabul, the flood, in this week's Parsha. They did everything they accused man of 100 times worse. Raped, pillaged the world, anything they wanted to do. So in other words, in a theoretical sense, as soon as they're transition from the intellect of heaven, it looked great up in heaven on a nice little LCD screen, right? That was great watching us and mocking us eating their popcorn. But as soon as they had flesh and they touched the body, and as soon as they went down and had desires and physicality, it was all over for them. But there was one who made the transition. Can you guess who that one was? Og. Og started off life as an angel, was given a human body, he descended to earth, and he did not fall. He was the only member of this race called the giants, the Nephilim, the fallen ones, who made it. He made it so much that he comes to Noah. Noah's building the ark. The floodwaters are rising. Knock on the door. They open up the door. There's this big giant Og there. No room for him on the ark, of course. Noah says, I'm sorry, Og, you can't come. Og says, could you ask God? So Noah, you know, gets out his Verizon phone. God, you know, there's a big guy here. What should I do? Yeah, let him on. He's going to help Abraham, your great-grandson, out one day in a big way. So let him survive. So they build him a special little ledge, and he has like a protective thing from the flood, and they feed him. I can only imagine the great cuisine that they must have given this giant man. And Og survives the flood. He's the only antediluvian other than Noah's immediate family that survives. And he lives and lives and lives, and he is the one who comes to Abraham and Sarah and says, by the way, look, your nephew was kidnapped by the kings Amraphel and the four kings. They took him. Now, he really wants Sarah to be his wife, and he's hoping old Abraham will get killed in battle, but it doesn't matter, right? He still did a mitzvah, he did a good deed, so much so that later when Moses faces him in battle, Moses is scared. He says, holy smokes, this guy survived everything. They call him the Palit, the escaper. He escaped from the flood. He escaped from the 4 and 5 king World War I. My gosh, he's a survivor, the ultimate survivor. Who knows? Maybe he'll survive me also. God says, Lo tirauto, don't be scared of him. Now, that is the simple understanding of why Moses is scared. There's another issue here, though. Og destroys in a court of heaven the credibility of Moses' argument for mankind. Because remember, the angels claimed they could come to earth and do better. Og's the only one who did. And he's the opposite of Moses. He's the mirror image of Moses. Moses, as we said, starts out as flesh and becomes an angel. Og starts out as an angel and becomes flesh. So he wasn't just scared of him because of his potential merit for helping Abraham out. He was scared of him because he represented, if you will, the only living testimony to maybe we shouldn't have created man. Maybe we should undo creation to destroy the world again. That was what Moses was worried about. Okay. Let's end with the question that we began at the beginning that I have not answered. Maybe nobody knows I haven't answered it yet. How in the world then, if Adam and Eve do not possess freedom of choice, how could they transgress God's will? That was our question, right? I think we now know the answer. Free will, as defined by Maimonides, the reshut, the license, has nothing to do with decision making. If I'm tempted to do something, I'm tempted by the pastrami sandwich. Oh, I'm on a diet, but oh my gosh, that pastrami and rye looks wonderful. Cholesterol, salt, it doesn't matter. I'm here at the kosher Noah's Ark in Teaneck. I'm going to imbibe a little bit, right? So that's a decision. Do you have the turkey sandwich, which is not as tasty but more healthful, or do you go for the full-fat pastrami? It's a decision that they had. To decide to follow the Nahash, the serpent's advice, that they had. When they eat, what happens to the fruit? Again, it's not part of human history. So what happens to the fruit? It becomes internalized. We as humans then gain something that we never had before. License. License to create real worlds or illusory worlds. Whatever our choice is, as Maimonides said. That's a totally different thing. In other words, decision making, to decide to follow someone's advice, that we always had as human beings. But the ability to create worlds, as Maimonides talks about, to be wicked, evil, rasha, to be a tzaddik, to be righteous, that was totally not given to mankind. That was the godlike power that we have to create. Totally different ideas. Again, one's decision making, one is something that will impact your soul, your life, our world. That was what they gained, for the better or the worse, by consuming from the tree. Okay, I think we're going to stop here for this evening. And I will wish everyone Erev Tov, a good evening, and I'll take questions off the record.